This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of A Prophet with Honor, The Billy Graham Story, by William Martin, published by Zondervan, and read by Maurice England.
Preface to this edition. Life is unpredictable. As explained in the preface to the original edition of this book, an unexpected invitation from Billy Graham in 1985 led to 5 years of near total immersion in the life of the famed evangelist and the people who held up his arms during more than 5 decades of public ministry. And then, with the completion of the research and publication of the book, immersion dwindled to a sprinkling. I continue to receive decision and monthly letters and press releases and exchange the occasional letter or telephone call with Billy Graham. I wrote articles for magazines and newspapers and talked to dozens, perhaps hundreds of reporters whenever Billy Graham was scheduled to hold a crusade in their cities or suffered an illness and as he passed the torch in stages to his son Franklin. But personal contact with people who had filled my life was largely absent and missed. Then, to my delight, Zondervan, now like my original publisher, William Morrow, under the HarperCollins tent, asked me to bring the 1991 edition up to date. For the most part, I happily relied on many of the same people who had been so helpful to me in preparing the first edition, particularly from Stan Gundry and Jim Rourke, who shepherded this edition to completion. As with the first edition, I've tried to tell the story of Billy Graham as accurately as I'm able. I do not doubt that additional information about Mr. Graham will surface from time to time after the publication of this book. I suspect with good reason that some of the Graham offspring will publish memoirs that will add to our understanding of their father and mother. If I'm granted sufficient additional years, I may participate in some widening and deepening of the story. But whatever the future, I feel enormous gratitude for the opportunity I've been given and satisfaction that the work already published has been well received. I trust that this expanded version will also make a contribution to understanding the life and work of a truly remarkable man and the movement he led for much of the 20th century. William Martin, March 2018. Preface and Acknowledgements. I can scarcely remember a time when revivals and revivalists did not fascinate me. As a small boy in Devine, Texas, in the late 1940s, I relished having the visiting evangelist over to our house for dinner during the annual gospel meeting. When the Baptist held a revival down the street, I often dropped in for a sermon or two, and numerous times I stood at the edge of a Pentecostal tent, wondering what might be going on inside the minds and bodies of folk being whipped into a holy rolling frenzy by the sweating, shouting, shirt-sleeved man striding back and forth on the flimsy little stage. I didn't hold any revivals myself until I was 14, but they were authentic for their time and place, held in the open air, illuminated by yellow bulbs, with a crowd seated on wooden slatted church pews and singing from tattered, soft-backed songbooks. Not all of my outings were a success. One dismal week-long revival seldom brought more than a dozen people out to sit in the oppressive August heat, and it was hard to be confident I had the full attention even of that faithful remnant, since the bare unfrosted floodlight directly over my head not only drew hundreds of night bugs, but with the intense glow of its high wattage fairly baked my crew-cut scalp and forced my auditors to look off to one side to avoid permanent damage to their stricken eyes. Still, I was a pretty good speaker, and my sermons were of sufficient quality to have merited previous publication. One of my favorites featured a stinging attack on the Bolsheviks, and when kindly church ladies said, "I'd sure love to hear you preach 20 years from now," I never doubted they would have the chance. As it happens, I don't preach much anymore. Haven't for over 20 years, but I'm still intrigued by those who do and are really good at it. Thus, when the opportunity came to chronicle and assess the life and ministry of the world's best-known and arguably most successful preacher, I saw it immediately as the remarkable pleasure and privilege it has turned out to be. Some explanation of how this happened and what followed seems in order. Throughout the 1970s, after joining the sociology department at Rice University in Houston, I wrote a series of magazine articles about popular religion, my primary academic specialty. Several of these appeared in Texas Monthly. In 1978, William Broyles, Jr., then editor of that excellent magazine, asked me to consider writing a profile of Billy Graham, whose Texas connections were numerous and strong. I already knew a fair amount about Graham, and had even spent several days interviewing members of his staff and meeting briefly with him during a crusade in Jackson, Mississippi. So the assignment was a relatively easy one. The article, which appeared in the March 1978 issue of Texas Monthly, was generally favorable toward the evangelist, but it was by no means a puff piece, and because I had liked and been treated graciously by every member of Graham's staff whom I met, I had some apprehensions about how it would be received. When the time comes to write, I have no conscious hesitation about trying to say exactly what I believe and feel about people and organizations I've studied. But I do not enjoy hurting people's feelings. And because I consider it of paramount importance to be fair in what I write, I like to be perceived as fair. On occasion, I've written things that ruptured or forever precluded the possibility of friendship. I will doubtless do so again. I can live with that, but it brings me scant satisfaction. I do not write as a means of venting repressed anger. When Graham and his chief lieutenant, T.W. Wilson, both wrote notes expressing appreciation for the article, and particularly for its fairness, I was pleased. Still, I knew enough about the evangelist's legendary graciousness toward the press not to imagine that the article had actually made any lasting impression on him. And I expected that my study of Billy Graham had ended. 3 years later, Graham held a crusade in the football stadium at Rice University. I urged my students to attend, and attended several services myself, but made no attempt to make contact with Graham or any of the staff members I had met several years earlier. I was quite surprised, therefore, to receive a letter from him several weeks after the crusade, stating that one of the biggest disappointments of his stay in Houston was not getting to see me, and expressing a hope that we might be able to sit down together for lunch sometime. I responded, letting him know that I felt sure I could work him into my schedule. But quite frankly, I assumed that his staff had prepared a list of people he might meet while in Houston, and that he was dispatching brief courtesy notes to those he had missed, lest someone be unnecessarily offended. Thus, despite these expressions of appreciation for my acumen and literary style, I was somewhat astonished when in November 1985, I received a letter from Mr. Graham in which he asked if I would be interested in writing a book concerning my life, ministry, and any niche in history our work may have. Several scholars and journalists had approached me about such a book, he said, but he had decided not to offer his cooperation to anyone else until checking with me about my interest and availability. As it happened, I was due for a sabbatical the following academic year, and had not yet fully decided on a primary project. To be sure, I was interested, but I was also uncertain as to what Graham would expect of me, and whether I would feel comfortable under conditions he might set. I let him know that I continued to think well of him, but would feel obliged to tell the story as accurately as I could, whatever that might entail. A few weeks later, we met for several hours in a New York hotel room. I thought it possible he might ask me to produce an in-house, authorized account of his ministry, one guaranteed to view him favorably. I would have regretted turning down the chance to look at him and his organization carefully, but I was prepared to do so if those were the conditions. I also wondered, though I considered it less likely, if he might expect me to pledge some portion of whatever income I derived from the book to the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. To my pleasant but perplexed surprise, we talked about our children and our wives, about what directions his ministry had taken lately and where he thought it might go in the future, and about why it would be simpler just to order sandwiches from room service than to go into a restaurant where people would almost certainly interrupt our conversation. Finally, when I knew we had to start talking about the ostensible reason for our visit, he asked, "Well, do you want to do the book?" I told him of course I did, but would need to find out what the conditions might be. He said, "There are no conditions. It's your book. I don't even have to read it. I want you to be critical. There are some things that need criticizing." He asked if I had an agent. I told him I did, and he correctly suggested that I should find a publisher. "We don't want any part of the income from the book," he said, "but you'll have a lot of expenses. How do you think that ought to be handled?" He indicated that friends of his organization could provide expense money if that were necessary. But he clearly had reservations, even about an arm's-length arrangement. I told him I thought it would be best if I took care of my own expenses. He readily agreed. "That's great," he said. "If we gave you money, I think you would know there were no strings attached. But others might not believe it. And I don't want anyone to think this is a kept book." He then gave me the names, addresses, and telephone numbers of people who held the keys to various treasure houses of information, assured me he would tell them I'd be in touch, and invited me to attend his upcoming crusade in Washington, D.C. Shortly afterward, he gave me a letter to present to publishers confirming his willingness to cooperate with me, and assuring them that neither he nor any person associated with him reserved any right of approval or editorial control over anything I might write. Mr. Graham proved true to his word. Over the next 5 years, two or three longer than either of us had imagined at the outset, I enjoyed cooperation of the sort that scholars and journalists dream about, but seldom experience. Long interviews with Graham himself had to be scheduled during downtimes between crusades and major conferences. But he was always generous with his time on those occasions, spending most of several days with me at his home or office in Montreat, North Carolina, over 3 years, and making himself available for long telephone conversations on other occasions. In addition, he sent word up and down the line of his organization that his friends and colleagues should feel free to speak openly with me, which more than 100 did. After several crusades I attended, Washington, D.C., Paris, Denver, Colorado, and Columbia, South Carolina, at the Mammoth International Conference for Itinerant Evangelists held in Amsterdam in 1986, and at a team and staff conference at the Homestead in 1987, I was given the opportunity to visit with scores of key personnel and access to any aspect of the operation I had sense enough to inquire about. On rare occasion, Graham chose not to respond to a question, usually indicating that he had pledged not to discuss the topic. For example, private conversations with presidents or other world leaders. That he preferred not to discuss the topic while other parties to an incident were still alive, or that he did not wish to cause undue pain to some person. In most cases, he was willing to answer the same or a similar question a year or two later. The few instances in which I felt he was less than fully forthcoming are noted in the text. This same generally open atmosphere prevailed at Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, BGEA, offices in Minneapolis, London, and Montreat, where I received warm and extremely helpful assistance virtually every time I requested it. Also of inestimable value was the assistance I received from Dr. Lois Firm, who serves as BGA's liaison with the Billy Graham Center Archives at Wheaton College. Certain materials in the archives, particularly oral histories, were donated with the understanding that they would be sealed until a certain date. Others were available only with express permission from Dr. Firm. The wish of donors was always correctly observed, of course, but in no case was I ever denied permission to examine any archival file over which BGEA held sole control. Dr. Firm expressed her conviction that early acquisitions by the archives had been placed under unnecessary restrictions. Later editions have seldom been subject to such stringent regulations. As the person who conducted virtually all the oral history interviews, Dr. Firm assured me that those still closed to inspection held no dark secrets. Given my experience with several dozen such interviews whose time limitations ran out during the course of my research, I have no reason to doubt her word. Finally, various personnel at Walter Bennett Communications, BGEA's media representative and public relations agency, as well as people holding similar positions within BGEA itself, have repeatedly furnished me with books, magazines, videotapes, transcripts, photocopies, and incidental bits of information that have proved invaluable in my research. As agreed in my early discussions with Billy Graham, I attempted to pay virtually all of the considerable expenses involved in preparing this book. On two occasions, when BGEA's large-scale dealings with its travel agent made it sensible and economical for the organization to furnish me with tickets for last-minute flights to major conferences, I accepted the tickets and soon afterward made contributions to the association in excess of what I believe the actual cost to have been. On numerous occasions, I was able to take advantage of special hotel rates negotiated by BGEA on behalf of its members. And though I always offered to pick up the check, some members of the Graham team paid for various meals during my visits to Crusades or BGEA offices. In similar fashion, I've tried to make contributions to BGEA or Samaritan's Purse, an evangelical social service organization headed by Graham's eldest son, Franklin, in excess of any financial expense directly incurred by BGEA on my behalf. To imagine, however, that writing a few checks cancels any debt I might owe to Billy Graham and his organization would be legalistic and naive. I would not try or even begin to know how to pay for the favors, assistance, goodwill, and gracious treatment I have received from numerous individuals, only some of whom are named below. They knew, of course, that I would write about Mr. Graham and his organization, and that treating me kindly and well would enhance the likelihood that I would speak of them favorably. But I want to believe, and do believe, that they treated me kindly and well because they tend to be, as a group, remarkably kind and well-meaning people. As I have written this book, I have constantly examined what I've said in an effort to make sure that I was neither shading the truth in Graham's or his associates' favor out of gratitude for their helpfulness, nor taking an inappropriately negative slant as a way of emphasizing that I had not been taken in by slick manipulation. Admittedly, I enjoyed writing about their strengths more than about their weaknesses. But since Billy Graham and his associates, like all humankind, have weaknesses, I determined not to gloss these over. I've tried to be scrupulously fair, not only because I do not wish the taint of unfairness to mar the most notable scholarly enterprise in which I've engaged to date, but also because I regard fairness as a cardinal virtue. I do not imagine, of course, that my judgment is flawless. I'm certain it is not. But the account and the assessments I have rendered here have been given with great care. My debts, as I've indicated, are many and substantial. I owe early and long appreciation to Dr. Kenneth Chafin, former pastor of Houston's South Main Baptist Church and former dean of the Billy Graham School of Evangelism. At our first meeting in 1974, when I was interviewing him about a different subject, Dr. Chafin half-seriously suggested that I consider writing a biography of Billy Graham. A year later, he invited me to spend several days at a crusade in Jackson, Mississippi. That visit led to the Texas Monthly article, which led to the invitation to write this book. I haven't talked to Ken Chafin much since he moved to Louisville, Kentucky, but I haven't forgotten him. T.W. Wilson, Graham's personal assistant and traveling companion, repeatedly went to extra lengths to help coordinate my visits with Graham, to provide entree to interviews and access to materials, and to supply me with various other kinds of information. It was easy to understand why Billy Graham has come to rely upon him so heavily and to relish his company. Cliff Barrows, even while recovering from a life-threatening illness, spent several days reviewing films of Graham's early ministry and sharing observations and insights gleaned during an adult lifetime spent at Billy Graham's side as his music director and vice chairman of BGEA. George Wilson and John Quartz, former and present chief of operations of BGEA, gave me broad access to the association's facilities and staff, and graciously met any need I expressed. Sterling Houston, director of North American Crusades, saw to it that I got every piece of information I requested about Graham's Crusade operations, and enabled me to get a worm's eye view of Crusades in progress. Maurice Rowlandson, director of BGEA's London office, shared his extensive knowledge of Graham's ministry in Great Britain, arranged interviews with key church leaders in England, and with his wife Marilyn, offered gracious personal hospitality and other kind assistance on several occasions. Dr. Alexander S. Harashti was a meticulously inventoried storehouse of detailed information about Graham's visits to the Soviet bloc countries. Dr. John Akers and Edward E. Plowman supplemented his accounts with their own observations and insights. Both these men also offered candid and astute reflections on other aspects of Graham's organization and ministry. Bob Williams gave hours of his time, even when swamped with responsibility, to help me gain a better understanding of the International Conference for Itinerant Evangelists and the saturation evangelism effort known as Mission World. Russ Busby, BGA's photographer, recorded hundreds of scenes that enabled me to picture exactly how an event looked, recommended several photos for use in this book, and furnished a stack of verbal snapshots that no camera could capture. I'm indebted, of course, to every person I interviewed. I hope each of them, including those not mentioned in the footnotes, will accept as sufficient my blanket expression of gratitude. Some, however, stand out for their willingness to engage in repeated conversations, for their assistance in providing access to other people, and for myriad other thoughtful deeds. I think especially of Dr. Akbar Abdulhak, Gerald Bevan, Ralph Bell, Bill Brown, Dr. David Bruce, Blair Carlson, Elwin Cutler, J.D. Douglas, Fred Durston, Alan Emery Jr., Colleen Townsend Evans, Dr. Robert Evans, Roger Flessing, Leighton Ford, Ernest Gibson, Melvin Graham, Roy Gustafson, Henry Holley, Mike Hooser, Dr. Arthur P. Johnston, Howard Jones, Johnny Linning, Dr. Robert L. Maddox, Dr. Victor Nelson, Roger Palms, Dr. Tom Phillips, Texas E. Reardon, Charles Riggs, Ted Smith, Walter Smith, Charles Templeton, Dr. Calvin Thielman, Bill Weldon, Dr. John Wesley White, Ralph Williams, and Grady Wilson. My research efforts were wonderfully extended by a competent core of co-workers. None was more valuable than my prized daughter, Dale Martin Thomas, who worked at my side for 2 summers and made further valuable contributions by writing her senior thesis at Yale on the conflict between Billy Graham and the fundamentalists, and whose research for that project is reflected in Chapter 13. She also enlisted her friend and classmate, Jim Ford, who provided me with information about Graham's visits to Yale in 1957 and 1982. Alongside her in importance is Jane Washburn Robinson, whose enterprising, painstakingly thorough, and expertly organized and documented research provided the basis for the chapters on the relationship between Graham and Richard Nixon. Though she was able to assist me for only 1 summer, and most of that via computer modem, Christiane Pratsch also proved to be as able a second set of hands, eyes, and mind as one could hope for. And during the final push to get all the footnotes correct, Shea Gregory displayed remarkable diligence, ingenuity, and cheerfulness as she hunted down every straggler who lacked a proper name or identifying mark. The bulk of my archival research was done at the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton College. The extensive and well-ordered collection at the center's archives is a priceless resource for students not only of Billy Graham's ministry, but also of other facets of evangelical Christianity. Archives Director Robert Schuster and his associates Lanai Graham, Francis Brocker, Paul Erickson, and Jan Noskowitz could not have been more helpful or gracious during the several weeks I spent in their midst. I received similar assistance from the center's library director, Femi Weimer, and her co-worker, Judy Fronsky. As already noted, my work at the archives was greatly facilitated by the good offices of Dr. Lois Firm, who was at pains to see to it that I had access to every piece of material that was legally possible for me to see. She was also helpful in suggesting places to look. In addition, my candid conversations with her and her husband, Dr. Robert Firm, associated with Billy Graham for over 40 years, provided many valuable insights. One of the most valuable sources of assistance was the staff of Walter Bennett Communications, which has long handled public relations and media operations for the Graham Ministry. Fred and Ted Dienert, gave me access to backstage operations of the television productions. Larry Ross repeatedly shared his time and insights into Billy Graham's phenomenal success in gaining the confidence of the world's media. And Noel Wilkerson Lee, again and again and again, found and sent videotapes, transcripts, press releases, and whatever other materials I requested, all in good time and good humor. Sarah Klemmer of the Charlotte Observer also smoothed my way to effective research in that newspaper's extensive files on Graham. As with virtually any historical project, I've depended upon the work of those who have plowed the ground before me. Earlier biographies, particularly those by John Pollock, William McLaughlin, Marshall Frady, and Patricia Daniels Cornwell, have been helpful for their insights and for guiding me to materials I might otherwise have found less easily or missed altogether. In addition, I have benefited from the work of numerous journalists who have written books and thousands of articles about Billy Graham. I have given credit for every known depth in the footnotes, but I take this opportunity to pay additional thanks to them all. From the beginning, secretaries have played crucial roles. Billy Graham and his colleagues are blessed. I have no more hesitation to use the word than they, with a phalanx of extraordinarily able and unfailingly helpful assistants. Stephanie Wills served as lifeline to Billy Graham himself, relaying queries accurately, dispatching all sorts of materials immediately, and giving information and advice that was invariably on target and often delivered with a wry sense of humor. Kathy Wood, secretary to Sterling Houston, not only provided me with abundant assistance at and regarding crusades and other aspects of the ministry, but repeatedly did so in the midst of hectic work days that lasted at least 15 hours. During the several weeks I spent in Amsterdam in 1986, Susan Cherian, Bob Williams' secretary, offered similar help with equal good cheer. Belma Ramers was especially helpful in arranging my meetings with Cliff Barrows and Johnny Lenning. Ruth Graham's secretary, Maury Scobie, helped me several times with appointments and travel arrangements and proved to be a delightful friend as well. I had only limited personal contact with Mary Becker in BGEA's Minneapolis office, but I was regularly grateful to her for faithfully sending me a full set of newly updated statistics every few weeks during the entire 5 years. And George Wilson's longtime assistant, Esther Liddell, managed to find copies of almost any obscure publication or document I felt I needed. In addition, and absolutely without exception, numerous other secretaries at various levels within BGEA in both the Montreat and Minneapolis offices rendered friendly and competent assistance whenever they had opportunity. I'm deeply grateful. On the home front, my several computers, whose value has been incalculable, made it unnecessary for me to rely heavily on the official skills of university secretaries in the actual research and preparation of the manuscript. Still, the friendship, forbearance, load-lifting good humor, and able assistance on other fronts consistently furnished by Kathy Koch, Crystalyn Williams, Nancy Dahlberg, and Rita Laux, during years of single-minded pursuit of a goal and absent-minded loss, usually temporary, of essential items have been a source of comfort. I can scarcely imagine how I could have written this book had I not been able to spend 18 months in practical isolation in comfortable dwellings graciously made available to me by thoughtful and generous people. Louise H. Wessendorf's picturesque and peaceful retreat center, Wellspring, not only provided much-needed solitude during the early stages of the writing, but rekindled a deep affection for the Texas Hill Country. The roar of the ocean at Lamar and Penny View's Seabean helped drown my inner moanings during the wintriest period of the entire project. The delightful 19th-century farmhouse at Pecan Mill, from whose windows I could watch champion cutting horses grazing in the fields, gave me a marvelous place to work and, just as important, enabled me to renew my ties with my cousins Mike, Jerry, and Bill McLean. And the magnificent view of the mountains made it easy to get through the final revisions and copy editing. I expect to write my next book at a place called Canaan, not far from Wellspring. All these will be welcome there. My several visits to Wheaton were made immeasurably more pleasant by Bill, Donna, Bruce, and Vicky Bond, who welcomed a stranger into their home and made him feel a part of their family. And my sojourn in Paris, a delightful assignment in itself, was enhanced by the hospitality and companionship of Spencer and Marlene Hayes and Irv Ottermatt. For more than 20 years, I've enjoyed an unusual degree of support and encouragement from my colleagues on the faculty and in the administration of Rice University. With scarcely a murmur of discontent, my dear friends in the Department of Sociology, Chandler Davidson, Chad Gordon, Stephen Kleinberg, Elizabeth Long, and Angela Valenzuela, my two deans, Joseph Cooper and James Pomerantz, and George Rupp, president of Rice University, agreed to my taking a 2.5-year leave to work on this book. I do not take such an environment for granted. The folks at William Morrow showed great confidence in this book, making it possible for me to both take time away from my teaching and to afford the research I needed to perform. I commend them for their generosity, thank them for their patience, and hope their judgment will be vindicated. I'm also grateful to their counterparts at other publishing houses, particularly at Macmillan Free Press and Houghton Mifflin, Tickner and Fields, who helped convince them that a book about Billy Graham would have wide appeal. Many people at a publishing house are involved in the production of a book, but none more intimately than the editor. My editor, Maria Gornaschelli, is a remarkable woman. When we first met, I was overwhelmed by her enthusiasm for the book. In the intervening years, I have been repeatedly overwhelmed by her capacity to demonstrate a range and intensity of emotion that exceed my own to a noticeable degree. Maria not only possesses superb technical skills as an editor, she also has two other gifts that make her a valuable collaborator: the ability to teach and the ability to learn, gifts that enabled me to find and to write the book I wanted to write. Two freelance editors also gave good assistance. After reading the first version of the manuscript, Joy Parker furnished 30 pages of thoughtful analysis and encouragement that proved extremely helpful, and Ellen Joseph helped pare their first version to a more manageable size. And finally, copy editor Michael Goodman patiently checked facts, spotted typographical errors and inconsistencies, and brought the manuscript into line with William Morrow's stylistic conventions. Jerry McCauley has been my literary agent for 20 years. We've been friends throughout that period, but never have I valued the friendship so highly as during these past 5 years. From his wise and effective assistance in helping arrange for the original contract, through regular telephone calls to calm my fears and assure me that all books were difficult and that many authors actually finished them, to reading and commenting on various drafts of the manuscript itself, he demonstrated a care and concern that went far beyond a mere professional relationship. And now perhaps we can talk about baseball without being distracted. My wife, Patricia, has been her dependably wonderful self throughout this long process. When it became clear that the only way to get the book written was to retreat from the city, she bore my long absences with uncomplaining grace, brightened my weekends with her warm and cheerful presence, gave and resisted giving criticism in just the proper proportion, and appeared never to doubt that I could and would eventually finish. My sons Rex and Jeff, their wives Mary and Suzanne, and my son-in-law Rupert Thomas were less directly involved, but they supported me with their encouragement and love, as did my longtime friends David Berg, John Bowles, Sidney and Mary Lee Burroughs, Alan Matusow, and Richard and Michael Parton. I understand that I am a fortunate man. William Martin. Part 1. Genesis. Chapter 1. Mr. Graham Goes to Washington. Billy Graham arrived at precisely the right moment. Some who jammed the interview room at the National Press Club looked as if they might be first assignment reporters for their church's weekly newsletter. But most had the countenance and equipment of men and women accustomed to confronting the familiar figures who provide grist for the evening news and the morning editions in the nation's capital. Still, even those well-seasoned veterans seemed to acknowledge the sheer physical presence radiated by the world's most famous preacher, a man who is by almost any measure the most successful evangelist in Christian history. As Graham and his small retinue took their places at a table, it was hard not to be surprised that, despite his 6'3" height, his shoulders are rather narrow, his chest thin, and his legs outlined when he crosses them in a loose-jointed way, almost skinny. Only the large, expressive hands seem suited to a titan. But crowning this spindly frame is that most distinctive of heads, with the profile for which God created granite. The perpetual glowing tan, the flowing hair, the towering forehead, the square jaw, the eagle's brow and eyes, and the warm smile that has melted hearts, tamed opposition, and subdued skeptics on 6 continents. After a press club welcome and warm praise from the co-chairs of the 1986 Greater Washington Crusade, Billy Graham took center stage. With a manner that suggested he still marveled that a simple country preacher found favor with famous and powerful people. He recalled how legendary House Speaker Sam Rayburn arranged for him to use the Capitol steps for the closing service of his 1952 crusade. Mentioned that Ben Bradley asked what the Washington Post could do to help the present effort. I told him that all we want is the first headline every day for 8 days. Revealed that he had discussed the crusade at private dinners with President and Mrs. Reagan, Vice President and Mrs. Bush, and Secretary of State George Shultz, and at meetings with Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger and other cabinet members. He told of an international conference his organization would host that summer at a cost of more than $20 million and revealed an ambitious plan to use satellite technology to preach the gospel simultaneously to virtually the entire world. Then after lamenting the return of the Elmer Gantry image among television preachers, Billy spoke of his anguish over continuing racism, his concern for the hungry and homeless, and his determination to do what he could to foster bilateral nuclear disarmament and world peace. When he opened the floor for questioning, noting ahead of time that he would sort of beat around the bush on purely political issues, Graham displayed a well-honed skill at fielding and finessing what turned out to be a quite routine set of inquiries. 40 minutes later, as the reporters packed up their gear, Graham's lifetime friend and primary gatekeeper, T.W. Wilson, drew public relations specialist Larry Ross into a corridor for a quick assessment. They agreed the conference had been a bit of a letdown. Graham had prepared for a tough session and got nothing to hit but softballs. None of it would win much airtime or newspaper space. They also registered disappointment over a Washington Post article that appeared that morning. That guy spent 2 hours with Billy, but it didn't reflect it. They had higher hopes for a New York Times story because the reporter was a Christian. "Give the Times, USA Today, and the other big papers all the time they need," Wilson said. "Try to spare Billy from the others. We need to move out of here as soon as possible and get over to CNN. 2 days before the crusade would begin, Graham met with his team for a serve-yourself continental breakfast in a conference room at the Key Bridge Marriott Hotel in Alexandria. All but he and 2 or 3 of his closest aides stayed at the Marriott. To protect himself from a potentially endless parade of supplicants, Graham nearly always maintained separate quarters, taking most meals in his room. Typically, he stays in a comfortable suite in a good hotel, but lest the press find out and create an unfavorable impression, he seldom accepts the ultra-luxurious suites pressed on him by admiring hoteliers. The pre-crusade team breakfast is one of the few occasions when most staff members will see him, except on the crusade platform. In public, Graham wears well-tailored suits that give him the look of a statesman or an investment banker. Here among his friends, some of whom have worked with him for 40 years, he sported his favorite informal outfit, moccasin-style gum-soled shoes, nondescript gray trousers, and an off-the-rack, bright blue blazer. His hair, as usual, needed trimming, and would have benefited either from a new application of Grecian Formula 16, a concession to television rather than vanity, or simple recognition that longevity is one of his greatest assets, of which a mane of gray hair would be a fitting symbol. Most of the men on his staff appeared to have chosen their clothes for utility rather than style. Several sported toupees. Only one had bothered to try for a match with the texture and color of his own hair. They make up one of the most efficient and effective event-producing organizations in America. They remind one of the Lions Club in Dothan, Alabama. The women, mostly wives and secretaries, cut a similar figure. Neat but unflashy, competent but ever friendly, well able to take care of themselves, but accustomed by ethos and experience to attend to the needs of others. As a group, these pleasant, unassuming, thoroughly dedicated men and women represent the elite of evangelical Christianity and the middle of the middle class. Graham opened the meeting with a few words about the importance of the crusade, then relinquished the chair to Sterling Houston, director of North American Crusades for the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, BGEA. A trim diplomatic man who favors precise speech and is ever at pains to shine the best possible light on the evangelist and the association. Houston urged the team to regard its interaction with the Marriott staff as a kind of ministry, taking care to display a consistently courteous and friendly attitude and inviting them to the crusade services. On a practical note, he reminded them that the hotel restaurant's cold breakfast buffet would provide as much as they wanted to eat, with plenty of cereal and fresh fruit at about half the cost of the hot buffet. There followed a series of brisk reports, most packed with statistics, in which various team members summed up the preparation and current status of the aspects of the crusade under their direction. Washington Crusade Director Elwin Cutler, one of several BGEA staffers who moved to cities a year or two in advance to oversee the development of committees and other crusade preparations, declared how amazing it had been just to stand back and see how the Lord worked in ways beyond human understanding to bring to the front the leadership he wanted for this crusade. To illustrate this point, various team members told how 16 major committees, all carefully integrated and headed by black and white co-chairs, had organized 8,000 volunteers into an elaborate network of prayer, Bible study, and work groups. Workers had issued over 500,000 personal invitations and distributed 400,000 packets of promotional material to homes in the greater Washington area. Thousands of small prayer groups had met regularly for months, and thousands more, who belonged to national prayer chains, had implored God to smile on this effort. Nearly 4,000 people had been taught how to counsel those who would come forward at the crusade services, and another 1,000 would lead nurture groups for new converts after the crusade ended. The Billy Graham School of Evangelism, an intensive training program held in conjunction with every Graham Crusade, would enroll 1,750 pastors from 79 denominations and all 50 states in a 5-day program designed to help them become more effective evangelists in their home communities. In similar fashion, other team members reported on special efforts to minister to blacks, young people, college students, military personnel, political leaders, and prisoners, and on the Love in Action program that collects food for disbursement to the Crusade cities hungry and homeless. As a capstone to this triumphalist litany, United States Senate Chaplain Richard Halverson spoke almost worshipfully of Graham's visits on Capitol Hill. "When Billy Graham comes to the Capitol," he said, "suddenly the Senate and Congress are unimportant. To me, it's a miracle. Wherever Billy is, there is the gospel of Christ. Everybody knows what he stands for. So he says it without a word. Just yesterday, after he opened the Senate with prayer, it was almost impossible to get away. Pages wanted to get his autograph. Senators kept coming off the floor to talk with him. It was just absolutely exciting. Here is a man who personifies the gospel of Christ, the love of God in Christ. Wherever he goes, all over the world, it's not like they are receiving just him. It's like they are receiving Christ. I wish that were true of more of us." Such a potent witness apparently has its downside. Graham observed that the devil is also at work, citing as proof the afflictions that had befallen 3 of the men who had stood at his side in virtually every crusade since the 1940s. His longtime song leader, Cliff Barrows, crusade pianist Ted Smith, and associate evangelist Grady Wilson, a high school friend who had been present when Graham preached his first sermon in 1936, were all ailing. "I'm sure this is an attack of Satan," Graham said. "We have had a number of things happen that have no other explanation to me, and we need to build a wall of prayer." At his direction, the people at each table began to pray, softly lifting petitions for the matters that burdened their hearts. As the room filled with the earnest sounds of heaven-directed entreaties, Billy Graham prayed especially for those who think they are not interested in religion, but are, for those who laugh at cocktail hours, but are not happy. Others prayed for the hotel staff, for team members out visiting prisons, and for those trying to solve parking problems around the downtown convention center. When enough time had passed to ensure that most key needs had been covered, Chaplain Halverson brought the meeting to a close by asking everyone in the room to touch Billy Graham, or someone who was touching him. Then, as they linked in an unbroken chain of support, Halverson offered a fervent prayer commending the evangelist to the Almighty as Mr. Gospel, the incarnation of the teachings of Jesus Christ. An old black prophet, shuffling along inside a word-jammed sandwich board, tried to convince the thousands who streamed past him into the convention center that Billy Graham was an aide-de-camp to the Antichrist. But they did not buy it. To them, as did Chaplain Halverson, he was the living symbol of evangelical Christianity, the man who had preached Christ to hundreds of millions of people throughout the world, and now brought his message to the capital of what many still regarded as the Redeemer Nation, the nation with the soul of a church. Inside, some grabbed Cokes or hot dogs at concession stands. Others lingered at tables set up in the center's cavernous lobbies, browsing over devotional guides, souvenir picture books, how-to manuals on personal evangelism, and rapidly shrinking stacks of volumes by and about Graham and sundry relatives and associates. For the most part, the assembling multitude was solidly middle and working class, clean, neat, and conforming to standards of dress and decorum they felt best reflected their self-image as the good, decent people who affirm and embody the core values of American society. A well-schooled usher corps funneled folks into the stands or to special areas for the deaf or for those who spoke one of eight foreign languages into which the service was being translated. In the cramped quarters of a TV production truck parked at a loading dock off the main hall, a small crew checked monitors and controls as they prepared to transform a live service into a television program that would be seen by millions a few weeks later. Meanwhile, in one of the center's many conference rooms, Elwin Cutler gave instructions and seating assignments to the ministers and other professional churchmen whose contribution to the crusade would be honored by a spot on the platform. A tangible symbol of importance to massage their egos, impress their parishioners, and consequently boost attendance. In another room, comfortably furnished with sofas and chairs and stocked with an abundance of soft drinks and snacks, Billy Graham spent the last few minutes before the service visiting with former District of Columbia Mayor Walter Washington, Mayor Marion S. Barry, Jr., and Vice President George Bush. When the appointed moment approached, T.W. Wilson unobtrusively indicated it was time for this inner circle to join Elwin Cutler's larger group in its procession to the platform. Inside the arena, the choir fell silent, and attention shifted to the stage where the organ, piano, and synthesizer sounded the first notes of Yesu, Joy of Man's Desiring. Moments later, as Graham and his party mounted the rear steps and came into view, 25,000 people rose in sustained ovation. Because it was the opening service, introductions ran somewhat longer than usual, but they provided a good view of the thin line between church and state, and of Billy Graham's position as an icon not just of American Christianity, but of America itself. Mayor Washington, noting that he had raised the first dollar to build the magnificent convention center, announced that Billy Graham came to Washington, like Queen Esther in the Bible, for such a time as this. Mayor Barry, observing that it was he who brought the $98 million facility to completion, praised Graham's stand against apartheid in South Africa and racism in America, then assumed the evangelist's support of the mayor's own programs regarding drugs, unemployment, the rehabilitation of prisoners, and sex education for young people. To close, Barry wrapped his own career in the mantle of God's providence, noting that his rise from a sharecropper's shack in Mississippi to the leadership of this great city and a spot on the platform with Billy Graham proved that the Lord moves in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. George Bush provided the final cachet. "We welcome to America's city," he said, "America's pastor, Dr. Billy Graham." He affirmed his own belief in the separation of church and state, but insisted the nation would be strong only so long as its faith is strong. And he thanked Graham for his role in reawakening the faith of citizens in this one nation, under God, the last, best hope of man on earth. Other preliminaries included a stirring religio-patriotic song and a low-key collection. Then, just before Graham spoke, America's beloved singer of sacred songs, George Beverly Shea, a gentle bear of a man who became the first member of Graham's team in 1944, stepped to the microphone, anchored himself to the pulpit with both hands, and sang, "In times like these, we need the Bible. This rock is Jesus. Yes, He's the one." At 77, Shea sounded 20 years younger, his deep, rich voice rolling out over the auditorium and settling on the audience like a down comforter. With no further fanfare at most services, Graham receives no introduction whatever. America's pastor began to speak. He commended local officials for giving the greatest cooperation we've ever received in any crusade we've ever held, announced that on Tuesday night he would talk about the richest and sexiest man who ever lived, and urged everyone to make a special attempt to fill RFK Stadium for the final service the following Sunday. Then, apparently because he feels a preacher ought to tell a few jokes to show he is a regular fellow, he related a couple of the small handful of stories he has been repeating for decades. Neither was a four-star anecdote, but the crowd laughed generously, as crowds often do when famous non-comedians tell jokes. The sermon, when he finally got to it, was a classic piece of Graham homiletics. Its theme was Christ, and its five subheadings were the creative Christ, the compassionate Christ, the crucified Christ, the conquering Christ, and the coming Christ. As in virtually all his sermons, he recited a laundry list of problems: poverty, drugs, broken hearts, emptiness, guilt, loneliness, spiritual blindness, and fear. He knew these were problems, and that secular remedies were bound to fail, because one of the greatest biochemists in the world, and rocket scientist Wernher von Braun, and Harvard president Derek Bach, had told him so. He had other evidence as well: a Roman Catholic priest studying for a Ph.D. in Chicago, Simon Le Bon of the rock group Duran Duran, a girl in Japan, the managing partner of one of Washington's most prestigious law firms, a new movie out, a recent Gallup poll, a magazine cover story, a taxicab driver on Donahue, a letter that came to me last month, and most important of all, the Bible says. To no one's surprise, Graham proclaimed with monumental conviction and certainty that the sole and sufficient answer to these problems is Jesus Christ. In the early years of his ministry, he spoke with such volume and driving rapidity that journalists dubbed him God's machine gun. He can still generate considerable intensity when the topic and occasion demand it. But his style has become almost conversational, and the conversation has a tendency to ramble despite his increasing use of full manuscripts. Nonetheless, many of the familiar gestures, the clenched fist, the pointing finger, the ambidextrous slashes, the two-pistol punctuation, the hands drawn down to the Bible like twin lightning bolts, are still there and still riveting in their effect. The sermon moved inexorably to its goal, the invitation to accept Christ for the first time, to receive assurance that one's prior acceptance and salvation are still under warranty, or to acknowledge a backslid condition and to rededicate oneself to walking a straighter and narrower path. Life is uncertain, he said. God does not give us the date of our death. And then, the words that bring virtually every sermon of his to an end. I'm going to ask you to get up out of your seat and come and stand here in front of the platform and say by your coming, tonight, I want Christ in my heart. As he suddenly fell silent, his head bowed in prayer, chin resting on right fist, elbow cradled in left hand, the convention center swelled with the simple melody and words of the quintessential invitation hymn, Just as I am, without one plea, but that thy blood was shed for me, and that thou biddest me come to thee, O Lamb of God, I come, I come. And from every section of the auditorium, they came, they came. Serious of mien, but devoid of tears or other overt signs of emotion, more than 1,000 souls answered Billy Graham's call to be washed in the blood of the Lamb. The response pleased the crew in the television truck. Pan around and pull. Camera. 3. Let them walk through. We want movement. Stand by one. Give me the shot with the aisles. A little further right. That's nice. Would you look at that? They're still coming. The program would not air for several weeks, but Graham stepped back into the pulpit to say, to you watching on television, at home, in a hotel room, in a college dormitory, wherever you are, call that telephone number you see on the screen. Then to the inquirers, who had streamed into a large open space immediately in front of the platform, he said, you've not come to Billy Graham. I have no special powers. I'm just another human being like you. I'm just the messenger. The message comes from God. You have asked for His forgiveness. I want to tell you on the authority of Scripture that He will give you that forgiveness, not because you deserve it, but because Christ died for you, and He rose again, and He's alive, and He's willing to come into your heart now by the Holy Spirit and give you a new power, a new strength, a new joy, and a new peace. He then led them through the sinner's prayer. O God, I'm a sinner. I'm sorry for my sins. I'm willing to turn from my sins. I receive Christ as my Savior. I confess Him as Lord. From this moment on, I want to follow Him and serve Him in the fellowship of His church. In Christ's name, amen. This ostensibly life-changing transaction, so simply accomplished, he urged them to read the Bible every day, to pray regularly, and a witness for Christ by inviting others to become Christians, and by manifesting a loving and helpful spirit, particularly across racial lines. Finally, he encouraged them to affiliate with a church and worship regularly, not just stay home and watch TV preachers. Many are far better than I'll ever be, but Christians need to worship together. With that, Graham left the platform and his associates took control, making sure all inquirers were matched with counselors who would help them clarify and confirm their decisions. As the last remaining strays found shepherds, the area began to hum with quiet conversation and prayer. Counselors helped their charges fill out decision cards and gave them a booklet entitled The Living Christ, a copy of the Gospel According to John, a brief Bible correspondence course, and suggestions for further study. The cards would reveal that few inquirers were confirmed pagans. Most already had some connection to a church or had come to the crusade as the guest of a church member. Within minutes, runners rushed the decision cards to rooms where a co-labor corps of over 200 volunteers waited to feed them into an elaborate follow-up procedure designed to link them to cooperating pastors and channel them into local congregations. The head of this operation, Dr. Robert L. Maddox, who had served as Jimmy Carter's liaison to the religious community before becoming executive director of Americans United for Separation of Church and State, admitted that the crusade could not be expected to reshape Greater Washington. Billy will go home next week, and the city will swallow him up, and the effects will be gone. But as a matter of fact, in the lives of individuals, it may be absolutely pivotal. I've seen that happen. It won't rock Washington, D.C. for the Lord, but it might make some congressmen struggling with key legislation think a little bit differently. Last night, I watched two or three guys that I know who grew up out here in Virginia and were as segregationist as they could be. They were working right alongside black people without any regard to color at all. When this is over, white churches will still do their thing, and black churches will do theirs. And there's not going to be any great crossing of that line, but there will be